This is the Ventured Growth Podcast with Hercules Capital, where you will hear from today's leaders in the venture ecosystem as we explore their perspectives and personal stories. I'm your host, Katie Sagan, and in this podcast, my colleagues and I will be speaking to top CEOs, CFOs, and investors in venture and private equity-backed and public companies. In these conversations, our guests will share with you how they scaled their businesses and how their interests and life experiences have shaped their paths to success. Enjoy the show. Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Ventured Growth with Hercules Capital. Today we have Janice Bork from the Hercules Capital team speaking with Rich Aldrich. Rich Aldrich is a co-founder and partner of Longwood Fund. Before Longwood Fund, he founded RA Capital Management, a life science investment fund with a total market value of over $9 billion. Rich also co-founded and helped build several biotech companies, including Certrus Pharmaceuticals, Concert Pharmaceuticals, and Vertex Pharmaceuticals, among others. We're thrilled to learn from Rich's diverse experience within the life sciences, from his time in operations through his transition into private and public investing. In this episode, we'll talk about key life lessons in operations and investments, the advantages of public investing, the attributes of a strong management team, Rich's reflections on the industry's evolution and weaknesses, and much more. Thank you for tuning in today. Without further ado, enjoy this conversation with Rich Aldrich.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Janice Bork. I'm managing director in the life science practice here at Hercules Capital. My guest today is someone who's been with the life science industry probably from the very beginning. Rich Aldrich, one of the founders of the Longwood Fund. Thanks for joining us, Rich.
Thanks for having me, Janice. It's good to see you.
Good to see you, too. You know, Rich, as I mentioned, you've been in the industry a real long time.
Yeah, I started when I was 10 years old. So,
well, then you're looking wonderful. But after you had your experiences being in a company, a life science company, what made you decide to become an investor versus joining another company?
Well, I was in an operating role at Biogen and then was a co-founder at Vertex and was an operating guy there for about 12 years. And when I left Vertex, I was certainly had people approaching me about joining another operating company in a CEO role or whatever. But I decided I wanted to do something where I didn't have quite as much of a total commitment of time and focus, where I was traveling constantly and had to be on the job all the time because I had a big staff and all that reporting to me. And being involved in the finance side gives you opportunity to sort of control your schedule and what you do. You still work very hard, but you have a lot more flexibility on where you work and, you know, when you work and all that. So I decided that that would be something I'd like to try out. And I had some strong thoughts about where the opportunities were. So that also fed into it.
Well, so your experiences, though, at Biogen and Vertex, how do you think that helped you as an investor?
It helped a lot as an investor. And I've certainly been on a lot of boards now with people who have not had that sort of operating experience. When you're on the sidelines, you have these people who are really smart and they can sort of analyze the situation. But I don't think they see it the same way the operating people do. As an investor, when I'm working with a CEO and a management team, I can very quickly sort of understand what they're thinking, what they're trying to accomplish, and what their concerns are, and look at it in a more sort of immersive way than somebody who's just made an investment and is trying to manage that investment.
So you went off and you created RA Capital.
RA Capital, yes.
Yes. And it was interesting because at the time, the companies were predominantly private. There was just no public market and only a few were public. So what made you decide to create a fund that actually was going to engage not only in the private side, but on the public side?
Well, so this was 2001. So there certainly were a lot fewer public companies than there are now, but there was a pool of public companies. And when I left Vertex, I had a lot of probably 7 or 8 venture capital funds approach me about potentially joining them and making investments in private companies. But at the time, there was a lot of money in venture funds, but I didn't think there were that many deals to really provide good enough opportunities to all that money. And the opportunity in the public side was very interesting because at that point, that was when we had the big dot-com bubble burst. And in parallel with that bubble bursting, you had the genomic sequencing bubble burst. And if you remember, we had that wild time where Celera would find a new gene and their market cap would go up by 10 or 15 billion. And that was sort of in the late 90s. But that completely burst in 2001. And it took down the overinflated hype companies, but it also took down companies that actually had value, took them down to incredibly low valuations.
A little bit of what we're seeing today.
Yeah, I think we're seeing a downsizing or right-sizing of the market after 11 years or whatever of basically free money. But in any case, in 2001, it was a real chance to pick up companies with pretty advanced development on drugs, experienced management teams, good partnerships with big pharma, and they had all been discounted dramatically, or most of them had. So to me, that's where the opportunity was. I spent a fair bit of time thinking about and met some really interesting people in venture capital, smart, interesting people. But at that point, I decided, I think there's better opportunities on the public side. So decided to set up an office, and I hired Peter Kolchinsky, who had just finished his PhD at Harvard at age 24 in molecular biology. I brought in Peter, and I had said, we're going to do some investing. I'll be on some boards as well, and you can help me with that, support me on that, and maybe we'll do a little consulting. I took some of my money and put it into a Fidelity retail fund, and they had their active trader platform, and we hired, we rented office space, and Peter and I sort of sat in adjoining desks and looked at the market, and I tell them, this thing I think is very inexpensive right now, but take a closer look at their portfolio and what they're developing. And we basically started making some investments, and Peter really dug into it. That's the part of the sort of three things I talked about doing that he really latched onto. And so we started making investments, and we made some investments that panned out very well. And so we took, which was initially $4 million and I guess quadrupled it relatively quickly. We really got some momentum going on that front. So, but it was initially just my money. And then after, I guess, maybe a year and a half, 2 years, we sort of restructured things into a more traditional limited partnership structure and brought in outside money. Initially mostly from friends and family. Then we eventually got Duke on board. So that was the first sort of big institutional investor. And just grew from there, you know, with some ups and downs, but mostly up.
Yeah, I remember Peter. Before he graduated, he was very keen on trying to understand this venture capital thing. And he wanted to find out, how does one get venture capital pay attention to you as an entrepreneur and invest in your company? So he was going around talking to a lot of people, and he put his guide together, if you recall.
Yeah, the guy, entrepreneur's guide.
Yes, it is. It was. And it was actually very complete.
He still has that online, by the way, and he's, you know, added to it over the years.
Yes, I actually still give it out to entrepreneurs and tell them where to find it, because I think it's one of the most detailed guides and explains a lot, terminology and process. So I thought that was very, very good. So what did you learn about public investment?
Well, my experience at that point was all as an operating guy at Biogen and Vertex. And at Vertex, where I was the chief business officer. I was the first person I know of to get the title chief business officer.
So you created that.
Yeah, I created it. Benno Schmidt actually came up. They were trying to figure out what to call me because I was controlling basically everything that wasn't R&D. He said, well, he's a chief business officer. I remember I went to my business school reunion and people were yucking it up like, what's a chief business officer? Because no one had ever heard of the title. Now it's pretty common, not just in biotech. But I had had a lot of experience running a company or a big part of a public company. And when I left Vertex, we had like 600 FTEs and at a $4 or $5 billion market cap. So it was a pretty big company by that point. So I knew the ropes in terms of how the market treats you, how you have to basically live with the ups and downs because you're getting graded every day by the market. And that can be upsetting to employees when you go down with the market for, and it's not based on anything that's bad about your company, but it's just people's appetite for biotech or whatever. So I sort of knew how it all worked. As an investor in public stocks, the thing I learned, or the things I sort of laid out as principles that we'd work off of, are that you have to come up with your own valuation of a public stock and do the work to sort of figure out what's this worth. I mean, do discounted cash flow sort of thing. And on a lot of biotech companies, that's kind of pie in the sky, but at least you have some sort of framework. And then you come up with what you think is fair value. And if something's trading at fair value, it's not really of interest because you're looking for upside. But when you find something that's trading below fair value, you buy it and maybe buy a lot of it. And if it trades up, you know, you're not in love with it. So you either have to convince yourself that its value has gone up or lighten up on it if you think it's achieved fair value above fair value. So having that discipline where you don't get emotional about ups and downs of the market, but actually go by what your feeling of what the value is. And one of the things RE Capital does very well to this day is they'll watch something that they like, but they think it's too expensive, but they'll do a lot of work on it and they'll keep an eye on it. And then something will happen, like they'll have some little snag in production or whatever. The stock gets hammered and then they'll gobble it up like crazy because it hits a value they think where it's cheap. So I think it's kind of the money ball approach that you go by, where you're looking for inefficiencies in the market and then trying to take advantage of them. And RE Capital, I think, has done that as well as anybody over 20 years.
20 years. Wow, 20 years. That's amazing. So RE Capital is up and running. Peter's doing a great job. You now shift again and you go back and create the Longwit Fund.
When I left Vertex, one of the venture people I met was Christoph Westfall, who I was incredibly impressed by. And he's a super charming guy and really smart and a real entrepreneur. So we just sort of kept in touch. And he kept asking me to come and look at deals he was doing and asked me if I wanted to get involved. And I think I sort of wasn't interested in a few of them. But he was knocking out he started Alnylam. He started a couple others that have been very successful. In 2004, I was still with RE Capital. I was with RE Capital till about 2010. Christoph said he was starting this company, Certrus. I was a co-founder of Certrus. It's a company we co-founded with David Sinclair, based on the sort of the sirtuins, and resveratrol is a natural compound that some of the science was based on. But in any case, I got involved there as a director and a co-founder, but I remained at RE Capital. That was still my primary focus. But I then did a couple of other companies with Christoph, including Concert in 2006. And with Certrus, we sold it in 2008 to Glaxo. And I was sort of the point man on the sale, and that ended up being a very successful investment for everybody. Concert, I was chairman of the board starting in 2006 until January of this year when we sold it to Sun Pharma after a long roller coaster, which we finished with a pretty decent outcome, but it was one that took a lot of work. I'm very close with Roger Tung and Nancy Stewart, who I go way back with to Vertex days. So in any case, I started doing these venture deals around 2009, 2010. Peter was doing a great job running RE Capital, and I was less interested in looking at a portfolio of stocks with 20 names in it or 30 names in it daily what I really enjoyed was and still enjoy is working with a management team trying to be successful. And in the case of Inventure, you're doing it with several management teams at a time, but not just looking at stocks. And I'm not the guy to dig in and do deep research on public equities either. And Peter was definitely driving that effort in every way. So that's when Christoph sort of disentangled. He had been CEO of Certrus. He had gone to Glaxo for a couple of years, got some big company experience, blazed quite a path there with Michelle Dipp. And they were spinning out of Glaxo when they wanted to start a venture fund and asked me if I'd join them. And it seemed like a good time to leave. RA Capital was in great hands with Peter and Raj Shah. They were really had been driving the thing for a while. So that's when I went and started Longwood with Christoph and Michelle.
Yes. I remember Concert was one of our portfolio companies. And, you know, this whole concept of deuteration and how that can change the molecular weight of a compound and alter how it interacted.
Yeah, pharmacokinetics change.
Exactly.
And, yeah. It's exchanging deuterium for hydrogen. And it changes things in unpredictable ways, but in sometimes in a very significant way that can make a compound that's well known and older into a new compound that's better. So, yeah, I love that kind of concept, and we implemented it successfully. I mean, Roger is an amazing chemist, brilliant scientist, and really good CEO. And Nancy Stewart is just a talented at everything. She's a terrific manager. And you get to know Nancy, I'm sure, when you're investing. She's great. And so anyway, that's the type of thing I like, where there's fewer leaps of faith. You know, you're working with an active compound that does something good in humans and doesn't kill them. But if you can make it better, you've got something unique. The reason that we didn't turn Concert into a $10 billion company was patent issues, patent decisions that didn't go the way they seem like they should. But so we ended up doing a deal with Sun, which I think a pretty good deal, but we certainly had higher hopes. But that was a great experience and work. They had just an amazing team at Concert. Still, I guess a lot of them are there now, but that was a company that I really enjoyed working with and had all the ingredients, really good science, really good people, really good senior team.
Yeah. And they came up with a product.
Yeah. They did.
Right. And they made it, they're making a difference for people with alopecia. And that was really not a lot of companies before they're purchased actually get to a product.
Well, yeah, that's right. Coming up with a real product is hard to do. My Vertex experience certainly demonstrated that. And we had an HIV protease inhibitor that we launched with Glaxo that was not a commercial success. Then we had a hepatitis C protease inhibitor that launched after I left, which also had initial commercial success, but then got superseded by Pharmasset's drug, which is now Gilead's, Sovaldi. And then the thing that made Vertex successful out of all the programs they had was in cystic fibrosis for something that was not really predicted at all and wasn't even important to Vertex when they purchased Aurora Biosciences, which had a high throughput screening machine that's what they wanted.
Interesting.
Yeah. So biotech's very funny. You look at some of these companies that are started with really exciting scientific platforms, and what makes them successful has nothing to do with the original scientific platform. But good management teams figure out how to make something work.
I think that's something we've all learned. We sort of have a mantra that says, you know, if you have an A team, even if things go sideways, the A team can figure out what to do with that and how to do something and move it forward or change or pivot, but they find a way forward. And it's much better to spend your investment and time with an A team. But at the time, we were just building experience. The industry was young and we were, you know, not quite sure all that we were doing. There were some folks coming in from Big Pharma. They'd never worked in a little company at all before, but they had a lot of experience. And so over time, you developed sort of these management teams that created one company, then another, and learned from it. So now with public and private, How do you think that's different between when you think about investment in a public company and think about your investing in a private company? What's the nuances? You want them all to do well. You want the science to move forward. You want them to create a product. You want a good team. But what do you think is some of the nuances that you have to keep in mind?
Well, the simple question would be, why would you ever go public? And the answer to that is, that's where the money is. Biotech companies have an infinite need for money. They're infinitely, or not infinitely, but almost infinitely cash flow negative. But being a private company is a lot simpler. You don't have to worry about getting graded by the market every day. You don't have to worry about all these problems with employees who take a loan out on their stock value for the company, and then the stock craters and they can't pay their mortgage. They have to give up their house or whatever. I've seen all this stuff. So being a private company has some big advantages. And it, you know, when you're private, as long as you're well-financed, and usually in your first two rounds, you're not quite as under pressure. If it's a decent investing climate, you're not quite as under pressure to be searching for money all the time. You can focus on trying to move the ball forward on the R&D front. Whereas in a public company, you're under pressure, a lot of pressure, to show visible, tangible progress and milestones to keep your stock price up. Sometimes it doesn't matter what you do, the stock price is going down with everyone else's. And there's obviously a lot of companies right now that are dealing with that. So there are advantages to being private. But again, the real key thing is when you're public, you can finance, you can raise money. And you look at the 10, 11 years after, 2010 to 2021, with a couple of little hiccups in there, but it was a very friendly market for biotech, friendly equities market. The thing that worried me that whole time while we were in that free money, 1% interest rates, whatever, 0% interest rates, the thing that worried me was there wasn't a corresponding level of M&A that could justify those public valuations. And that's what you see has happened once the interest rates went up. There's other factors as well we can talk about in terms of drug pricing and the issues there. But there's some M&A, and maybe it's picking up because values are going down and entrepreneurs are more willing to sell. But it's made it tougher if you're totally dependent on a happy stock market, because you don't always have that. And I've been through a bunch of cycles. Lesson number one, if you're the business person in a biotech company, is, and I said this to Josh when we first started Vertex, I said, you don't raise money when you have to. You raise money when you can. So anytime you can sell stock at a higher price than the last time you sold stock at a good valuation, raise some money, because you may not get that chance again for a while. And the years 1989 and through 2000, when we did several big stock offerings, and then we did a couple of big convertible debt offerings in 2000, we always sold stock at a higher price than the previous offering. So we were building value and we were keeping the balance sheet very healthy. I think when I left, we had about $800 million in cash on the balance sheet. And we had all these deals we had done with companies so that we weren't burning that much money. We had other people's money working on our projects, yet we kept plenty of sort of commercial value, the downstream value. So the key in biotech is you got to know how to raise money. In the case of Vertex, we had all the ingredients. Josh was a great salesman.
You have to be able to tell your story.
Yeah, it's, I mean that in a positive way. He was able to take complicated science and make it understandable to people and get them excited with him about what we're doing. And he was tireless. I'd be on these roadshows with him where we do 8 meetings in a day and be then on a plane jumping to the next city. And he'd go into the next meeting and just, you know, have that same energy and excitement that he had in the first one. So when I look at a management team, one of the things I always look at is, can this team, are they high energy? Do they believe in what they're doing? And can they convince other people or help other people understand what they're doing so they'll want to invest? That's such a key ingredient. And obviously, you have to have great R&D as well. But you can have all the great R&D in the world. If you don't have the ability to get other people to understand it, you can't point to any sales numbers, and you're not going to be able to point to any sales numbers for years. So
yeah, you can't hold up a product.
Yeah, and you're talking about something that's way in the future, so you better be able to get people's attention and get them excited. So that, to me, is such a key part of what you need in a management team.
Well, let's talk about that science. So today, what's the type of science or technology are you interested in? What's exciting to you today?
Well, I've always liked things that don't require too complicated a platform and have too many big challenges to make them work. And I've been less interested than a lot of my colleagues in sort of the gene editing and all that stuff. I just think it's really difficult to get a real product. I understand the terrific innovation and all that, but getting something to be a drug product is a different situation. An area I'm very excited about, we're investors, and I'm on the board of a company called Axial, which is in the microbiome space, which has been a space that hasn't had a lot of success yet, but they've had some small successes, and they are developing a drug for autism that we'll have a pretty good answer in probably by February of next year. But there's a lot of reasons to think it's really going to work. And it's with a compound that's a known compound that we've modified or we're modifying for use in the gut. And everything takes place in the gut. So with other drugs, as you know, and systemic exposure to a drug requires all kinds of testing and concerns and making sure you're making it bioavailable, making sure it's not toxic outside of where it needs to be. But when you have something that's just happening in the gut, that's less complicated. And that's the type of drugs that Axial's developing. And the autism drug looks very promising. The preclinical work looks very interesting. And to date, from what we're seeing in the phase two sort of proof of concept study, which is a blinded study, we are encouraged just by the sort of gross numbers that we have a good chance to have a result. And autism's a difficult area, but it also doesn't have any good treatments and any treatments that are really safe for kids. So if we can show an effect that's comparable to the sort of anti-anxiety drugs that they're using now, it'll be a huge deal. So I'm very excited about that one. I generally like small molecule drugs as opposed to biologics, but there's all kinds of differences in how they get treated now with pricing and all that, that complicate things.
They do. I mean, I remember the days where it was the big challenge was the FDA, getting through the FDA and getting approved by the FDA. And now I find that it's past that. It's not just, yes, the FDA, okay, you have to do that, check the box, but it's payers. And how are you going to position on the market? And why will they use it? And how are you going to demonstrate to a potential company that might buy you that there'll be a market for it, even if it's the greatest product out there? So that's, I think, a new set of challenges that the industry had to become more experienced with. And I think the pharmaceutical industry helped with that. They were knowledgeable about it. But I think we are now all in a new place of trying to understand, how do you still advance science? How do you get properly rewarded for that? How does the market bear it? How do people bear it? How do payers bear it? Particularly when you're coming out with products that are one and done, right? If you can treat someone, how do you value that? And how do you pay for that?
The thing that small companies have to sort of understand is what they're good at. And if you're fortunate enough to have a drug that looks really good and you've done pivotal trials or you're close to being finished with that, do you really want to go into commercial mode when the people who have made you successful, the team that's made you successful, doesn't have commercial experience or as little of it? They tend to be more R&D people. And so the question is, when do you want to stick your neck out commercially, or do you even want to stick it out at all? Do you want to take your success and let someone else be successful making it commercial? because there are a lot of drugs out there you see get approved and get launched and just never get off the ground. For the big companies, they can do that and they can pull the drug or whatever. They can handle it. But for a small company, if you launch a product and it doesn't work, you're done. You see that happen now and then. So to me, it's also a matter of knowing when you're sort of at your value peak and you should take your chips off the table and go to another table and try something else.
For companies at critical development milestones, venture debt can serve as a key financing option to foster growth and minimize dilution. Venture debt is intended to complement equity with a solution that is less restrictive and more customizable than traditional commercial bank financing. Hercules Capital is the largest BDC focused on venture lending, with over $17 billion of capital commitments made to over 600 emerging growth companies. Since our inception, Hercules is the lender of choice for innovative entrepreneurs and their venture capital partners. Connect with us at htgc.com to learn more.
Have you liked the way we've evolved as an industry? And what do you think we need to do better as an industry?
One of the challenges is, as we all realize, you need the ability to price drugs high to provide the capital for future R&D. That's been under attack for decades, but in the last year, the IRA legislation was passed where it's really been the first breach in pricing where, you know, it's initially the highest selling 10 drugs or whatever, where they have to negotiate, quote unquote, negotiate. It's negotiating with a gun pointed at your head with Medicare. And they want, at least a substantial part of the political spectrum wants more than just what they've got now through the IRA. And in fact, the Biden administration asked for the IRA provisions to apply to all drugs in the most recent budget debate, but it fell out in the course of that, fortunately. But I think that is a big drag on biotech. And I don't think biotech has done a good job, or biopharma, because we're all in it together, really, has done a good job of making the case for why society should be willing to pay high prices for innovative drugs that save lives and actually save money over time. And my friend Peter Kulchinski has been one of the more active people on fighting that fight, really to his credit, because there's a lot of people who just haven't put in any time and effort in it, but Peter's really worked at it, and he's made the case, as I guess you probably know, which is a really smart way of looking at it, is you pay these high prices for the drugs, and then after 9 or 10 or 12 years, they become essentially free, but they're still effective drugs. And most scripts that are written, I think over 90% of scripts that are written now are generic drugs. Those are drugs that were higher priced, proprietary drugs at one time, but their patents ran out. And they are now the statins, for instance, for lowering cholesterol, widely, widely used. It cost almost nothing. They're dirt cheap. But people did pay full price for those for, I don't know what it was, it depends on which one, but 10, 12, maybe 14, 15 years. And so it's kind of a deal with society that, you know, we're going to get paid for these, but then you're going to have the drug for free for patients forevermore after that. And I think that's a good way of looking at it. And if we don't allow companies to capture a lot of value out of their successes, you're going to inhibit in the long term drugs that can really help society down the road, because there just won't be enough innovation happening.
And the U.S. continues to lead the world in innovation in this space.
Absolutely. Almost all the drug R&D innovation comes out of the U.S. And we're a rich country, although a little bit in debt. We should pay to have this R&D done. And I understand, and I always have been concerned about the perception of us selling, our companies selling drugs at a much lower price to other countries in the world than they sell them for to the U.S. market. And that is obviously one that requires a more complicated argument to explain that to people. And all they see is, why is England paying 30% of what the U.S. is paying? I think that's been one of the problems. I also just wonder, I mean, you probably remember back in the 1990s, Merck, the early 90s anyways, was considered the most, had the highest approval rating of any company in the world, most admired company for several years, and our biggest, most successful drug company. And they're terrific companies, still are, but doing great research, getting drugs out to people who needed them.
They were in vaccines at the time too.
Yeah, and they did some things that were not profitable for them, but good for society, that they just thought was the right thing to do, like treating river blindness in Africa and that sort of thing. But the image of pharma is not what it used to be. And I'm not sure what all the causes of that are. I think direct-to-consumer advertising has certainly changed the perception of pharma, where you have an advertisement for laundry detergent or Diet Coke or something 1 minute, and then you're seeing an advertisement for a serious treatment for a serious drug. And it just kind of cheapens the whole image, I think. I think that's had an effect.
That's interesting. I think you're the first person I know who made that connection to the ability to actually promote, because they couldn't before. They were restricted on where they could say it, what they could say, and to whom they could say it. And then I think when the door was open to allow more direct-to-consumer advertising, that's a very interesting point. I've not heard someone make that.
And I understand the benefit of DTC, because you can't count on your doctor to be keeping up on all this stuff. So in some ways, it's good to inform the consumer so they can come say, well, what about this drug? You know, I just saw something on that. It's supposed to help with my arthritis or whatever. So I understand the value. I guess there's got to be some middle ground where you have sort of more serious, dry, boring ads saying this drug is available, this is what it can help you with, something like that, rather than the sort of foofy, sometimes silly ads they make. So anyway, that's one thing. I think politically it's easier to take pot shots at pharma because you see the price of a drug. You go in and pick up the drug and you have a copay. You see that. You go to the hospital for what's certainly much less efficient, much less valuable per dollar spent interaction with the healthcare system. But it's so complicated and convoluted that nobody can figure it out anyway. So they somehow pay the bills and it gets paid or whatever. They don't even know who's paying it. I can't figure this stuff out. So I think drugs are an easier target because they're more tangible in what you're paying. You know, you say, well, what does it cost per pill? It's like Sovaldi, when that was launched for hepatitis C, and the sort of ticket price was $84,000. And my thought was, that is like the cheapest drug in the history of pharma, because you literally are curing people of this disease that will eventually kill you, will give you all kinds of health problems, require liver transplant and all that. And you have a 3-week course of treatment or something like that. You can get it completely cured for $84,000. No more burden on the healthcare system. And if they had had that price, if it was a drug that you needed to take for the rest of your life for $25,000 or $30,000 a year, no one would have complained. But the fact that it was 3 weeks and you were done, they're like, well, how can they charge me $84,000 for 3 weeks worth of treatment? You know, that gets back to the old joke, you know, you have in the pharma business, you know, never cure a disease. You know, they'll never forgive you for it.
Well, I know my perspective is that I'm glad that the public's awareness about the industry and the role that we play has increased, I think, significantly through the COVID experience. I think for a long time, albeit I think the public thought that a lot of products came through the NIH. They didn't realize it was early grant dollars, and the real development and the real investment came was when it went into the hands of a company.
It's the only way to get a drug.
That's right. And I think for a long time, companies were not acknowledged. Research institutions, physicians were recognized, but not companies. And today, I'm very happy to see that the companies alongside the doctors and the researchers are being recognized for bringing these important products to the market.
Yeah. And you look at some of the great scourges. You mentioned COVID. There's HIV has basically become totally manageable. And that's all through the efforts of drug companies that had all these protests against them and all this stuff and hard work getting a drug developed. And hepatitis C is another huge success case.
Right. This industry is not for the weak of heart. That's for sure. With that, I'd like to thank you very much, Rich, for being our guest today. I want to thank the audience for taking the time to be with us as we sort of explored Rich's experience, and we look forward to our next podcast. Thank you, Rich.
Nice talking to you, Janice. Thank you.